came in, I wasn't sure where I was supposed to stand, but I think I have an idea where I'm supposed to stand now, so I think it's supposed to be here. I'll probably wander around a little bit.
You can walk wherever you
want. Yeah, I was going to say, I'll probably wander around a little bit once I get the slide going. Is it this one?
This is for you.
Okay, so, yeah, I don't really like standing behind things. Okay. So I just want, I don't have very long, so some of the slides I'll flip through, and I'm going to ask if I can make the presentation available, because a lot of the slides I've got data on it, and it's just to give you an idea of the depth of the impact of what I'm going to be talking about, because I'm going to be talking about something I call legislated identity, and to try to give you an idea of how it impacts people. I don't think most people think about what that means. So I sort of have a number of slides with a bunch of data on it that I'll give you a highlight of, but you can go and think about it a little bit more. So I don't want you to feel I'm rushing you through it, but I only have an hour, and normally this takes me a semester with most of my students, so I just want you to be able to look at the data and use it as you like. I don't have a list of the sources at the back, so if you find you want the full references, let me know. So I just want to start with a quote by Mike Cookham, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about myself and where I come from. But this is Mike Cookham, Elder Betty McKenna, and it's something that really helped me to kind of find out my roots, and then I'll share a little bit with you about who I am and why I needed to find that, and what does that mean. Because I think for some people, it's automatic. You know where you're from. You were raised with your values. You understand that very well. And for others, that's not really the case. So she told me something once that stuck with me, and I use it with all the presentations that I do around identity and around anything to do with the Indian Act. And she said, you know, we're all like trees, you know, every one of us. It doesn't just apply to Indigenous people, but if you think about it, she said, we're all like trees, and our roots are put down very deep. And we take things from the four directions into our lives. If you pull us up by our roots, we're lost. And we have to go back and find those roots. We have to go back to the beginning, right? Those beginnings, find those roots, find those beginnings that are strong so that we can live a good life. And in most Indigenous languages and in the Anishinaabe language, which is what we are, there's no direct translation for health. So I say that I teach Indigenous health studies, but there's no direct translation for that. So living a good life is one of those translations, right? Being alive well is another translation, right? So sort of living in balance, you know, would be another translation. So living a good life, that's as close a translation to health as we can get it. So we have to know who we are, basically, is what she's saying. Right? For me, I grew up knowing I was a half-breed, and that's about it. That's about as much as I knew. Because that's about as much as my family wanted me to know. Because we experienced assimilation, which is a pretty nice word for cultural genocide. And it was a real shame for my family. So my grandfather, he raised me for most of my life. My mom and dad were teen parents. And he was really ashamed of who he was. And he knew a little bit, but not a lot. And what I've spent most of my life doing is reclaiming who I am so that I can live a good life and so I can pass that on to my children. And my children are a different story. They're very, very strong in who they are. My 16-year-old, she knows who she is. She's proud of who she is. And you will never tell her anything different. And she's out at Notre Dame. She's a AAA goalie. She's a very accomplished young woman. My husband is a Cree Métis from Red River. And so she's very clear in who she is. And if anybody says to her, like, you know, like, what are you? Because, she, you know, she looks a little different, right? And nowadays, kids are just straightforward, right? Like, what are you? They'll just ask that question. And she gives them a pretty good lesson. She'll say, like, who raised you? Well, you ask that question. Right? How can you ask that question? Like, what are you? And then they get stumbling, right? What do you mean? What do you mean? Well, why would you ask me that if you don't know who you are? You know? And it gets going like that. And then she will tell them. very, very clearly who she is, right? I'm a very proud Cree, Anishinaabe, Tlingit, Métis. Wow, that's pretty complex. Yeah, so? Right? Aren't we complex people? Right? She has no problem saying who she is. Very, very proud young woman. But it took me a long time to get there because I wasn't raised like that, because we were just half-breeds. And I wasn't treated very well in school because I was a dirty half-breed. Right? And a squaw to boot. So it's taken me a very, very long time in my life to get to where I am. And it's because of legislated identity. Come on in. So the Indian Act has had profound effects on Indigenous people. And I can only share with you the effects that I've experienced in my family, and it's not to glean any kind of pity or that I want you to feel sorry for me. I can only share my story and what I know. And I have to share that because otherwise it just looks like a piece of legislation and people say, well, so what? It's in the past. Isn't it over with? It's not over with. It continues to affect us. It affected my grandfather until the day he died. It continues to affect my family. It affects us in the over 1,200 missing and murdered women. It affects us every day. And even though I can tell you that I'm still on that healing journey and that I'm there, like my cooking reminds me, healing is a journey, it's not a destination. It's not going to be over. It's never going to be done. So I wanted to just share a little bit about what the Indian Act is, what it has done to people, what it continues to do to people, because guess what? We still have an Indian Act. And even though most people would say, oh, she's a Métis person, she's, you know, belongs to the Réel Métis local, I do, and I'm proud of that. But why do I have to just be that? Because guess what? I'm also Tlingit, and I'm Anishinaabe, and can't I be that as well? Or is it because the government says that I can't be? Right? Because it's a little more complicated than that for me. Because legally, my family were non-status Indians. But we got adopted into the Métis community. That's how we became half-breeds. It's never just black and white. It's never just cut and dry. Right? So I just want to talk about some of the sort of legal aspects of this and show you how things get really muddy and how Indigenous people in Canada, and I like to use that term because it's much more inclusive than the term Aboriginal, even though Aboriginal is the legal term in Canada. And I'll use Aboriginal when I'm talking about it in a legal term. But I want to talk about how we're one of the only countries in the world, there's only one other country, and I think it's Singapore. There's only one other country in the world that still defines their own Indigenous population. Not even Australia anymore. And we know Australia has pretty terrible human rights records against their Indigenous people. But Canada is the only country that still does this. Right? And I believe there's a reason for it, and I'll tell you why. So, Aboriginal is defined legally in Canada as Indian, Inuit, and Métis people of Canada in Section 35.1 of the Constitution. Okay? You'll notice it does not include non-status Indians. Okay? Aboriginal people, though, are very diverse. And so one of the reasons that many of us don't like to use that term is that when you hear the term Aboriginal, everybody assumes we're just all the same. We all sing hands, sing kumbaya, we all get along, and we all know each other. Right? So that's one of the reasons a lot of us don't like that term. It's another government term enforced upon us. We didn't have any say in this. We weren't involved in this at all. So some people are okay with the term, others are not. Identities have been shaped and continue to be shaped by colonial and neocolonial policy. If you think colonization is over, please, 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 after this lecture today, think again. I can't tell you everything in 1 hour, but I can give you a starting point, and there's lots of information out there. Colonial policy continues in a neo-colonial form. And the attempted cultural genocide of Aboriginal peoples continues to impact all of us today in one way or another, whether you're Métis, whether you're Inuit, whether you're non-status, however you want to say it, all of us are impacted today. So the Indian Act began in 1876. Of course, it began a lot earlier in earlier forms, which I don't have time to go through with you today, but officially was amalgamated in 1876. And between 1876 and 1985, one's Indianness, if you will, was traced through the male line. Very patriarchal in nature. So that means that Indian women who married non-Indians, and I'm using that in a very legal term, not in a derogatory way, ceased to be Indians under the Act. Okay? So these women were not Indians according to the Act, but neither were they Canadian citizens. What did that mean for Indian women? Again, I can only use my case, but in my case, that meant when my Tlingit status Indian great-grandmother married my Czechoslovakian great-grandfather who came through BC, far, far, far northern BC, and they married and they moved to Saskatchewan, and he died when my grandfather was six, what happened to her six children and her? She's not a Canadian citizen, and she's not an Indian. What do you think happened to her and her homestead? Any idea? She would lose it unless what? What would you do if you were a single woman and you're not an Indian and you are the sole burden and responsibility of your husband under the law? You're basically no better than chattel. Women in here, what would you do? You would find a man, wouldn't you? And that's what she did. Well, my grandfather, of course, was very upset because he remembered a quite happy home. Everything was fine until his dad dies. Dad dies, mom and goes marries a town drunk, and life changes. His new stepdad is very angry all the time, beats the kids, especially the ones who are happen to be a little darker, because you know genetics work. His dad was blonde hair and blue eyed, so some of the kids were lighter, some of them were more like his mom. My grandfather was more like his mom. By the time that my grandpa was nine, he couldn't take the beatings anymore, and he left home and worked as a farmhand for room and board, as a thrasher. When he came back home, one of his older brothers had died. He didn't believe it was from consumption. And the next time, his mom was dead. And you know who he hated for it? Not his stepdad. Who do you think he blamed for it? His mom. And he hated himself and he hated everything about himself until the day he died, which carried on in our family for generations. And there was alcohol abuse and drug abuse and all kinds of violence in our family for many, many, many generations, which, by the way, my family doesn't like me talking about. But I do anyway, because it's the reality and it's what happens, and we're only one of many, many, many families because of colonization and because of the impetus of the Indian Act and because somebody gets to tell us who we are and who we are not, and because women were treated like chattel. And men, meantime, didn't lose their status. In fact, they could marry non-Indian women and they would gain status, and so would their children. Women were targeted. And I'll tell you something else, women are still targeted. I'll tell you that in one moment. So in 85, the Act was revised because it conflicted with the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. If anybody tries and tells you it's because of those brave women that marched in Ottawa and fought for the rights and freedoms, I will fight you tooth and nail, and here's why. Because if that is why the charter was changed, if that is why Bill C-31 was implemented in 1985, we would not have the mess we have today. That is not what those women were fighting for. Those women were fighting for equality, and we don't have that. We still don't have that. In 1973, assimilation was officially abolished. Right? There's the white paper and they tried to do away with the Indian Act with Chrétien and Trudeau, and it was supposed to, you know, create equality. And we fought back because it would have gotten rid of all of our rights. Probably would have gotten rid of the treaties. Hi, Brad. Right? So they finally said, okay, assimilation is over. We want to forge a new relationship with First Nations people. Tell me if this is not assimilation. Tell me if this is what those women fought for in Ottawa. But I will make it a little late, because it gets a bit heavy. So Rob Nestor and I were facilitating one day. Rob Nestor still works at U of R, and I know still teaches, so I told him I was going to use his corny joke just to lighten things up, because it was kind of funny. So now, at 1985 and still today, there are now 6'1 and 6'2 Indians, but it doesn't refer to height. Ha ha, ha ha. It's corny, but you gotta break it up a little bit. So now there are 6'1 Indians, and that means in 1985 you already were considered an Indian according to the government, right? A 6'2 Indian means that you applied to get your status back, and 9 times out of 10 you will be classified as a 6'2 Indian. The government must have done something illegally if you're classified as a 6'1 Indian. So if you apply to get your status back, and you're classified as 6'1, the government did something illegal, pretty much. Because otherwise, you will get classified as 6'2. Then actually, there's 21 different kinds of Indians, from 6'3 to 6'21, because when I went to get my status back, initially I was classified as a 6'3 Indian, and I said, oh, what does that mean? And they said, oh, it means you're non-status Indian. Don't worry about those. So I don't know why they have those different categories, but they don't mean anything. What do you need to focus on is 6'1 and 6'2. So here's how it works. You tell me if assimilation is dead. A 6'1 plus a non-status, which includes a Métis or an Inuit, produces a 6'2 child. A 6'2 plus a non-status produces a non-status. Two generations. And what happens? Two generations, you've assimilated. Sounds like assimilation to me. Because if you don't marry or have children with the right people, you've now assimilated, right? But here's the funny part, which I think is funny. This is why Rob and I called this Indian Act math. A 6'1 plus a 6'2 produces magically a 6'1 child. And a 6'2 plus a 6'2 produces a 6'1 child. How does that work? Like, just magic. Ta-da! So, what's interesting about this, I find, is that when I was working, I'm going to date myself now, way long time ago for the government, I didn't last very long there, but we had a meeting with the FSIN, and they were all up in arms about this, because they were like, hey, eventually everybody's going to be Métis, because where do you think people are going to go when they lose status? They're going to be adopted into the Métis community, because that's what happens. We take in people that need to be taken in. I mean, that's ultimately what ends up happening. And I'm sitting there, and they're like, no offense, Carrie. And I'm like, I'm taken. That's okay. But the Métis population is going to grow, and the First Nations population is going to shrink, ultimately. That's what they were worried about, and rightly so. And they said, look, assimilation is alive and well. Look what they're going to do with this bill. And so they were getting really upset, and one of the elders finally stands up and says, oh, I got something to say. So elder is going on and on and on about his grandchildren. And I knew it was a way to get everybody to settle down, but they really wanted to get back to talking about this issue. But the elder had a point. When the elder ended up at the end talking, he said, but you know, he said, it's really hard being an elder. You have to talk about safe sex and use a condom and all these things, and kind of uncomfortable, I think, for some of them hearing an elder talk about this. He goes, but I tell my grandchildren, I say, you know, when you're making out in the backseat of that Chevy, make sure you ask the right question. And everybody thought that he was going to say, you know, do you have a condom, right? And he said, make sure you ask, are you 6'1 or 6'2? Right? Because his point was, why should we have to be asking that question? Does anybody else have to ask that question? Does anybody else have to worry about that to retain our rights? Legislated identity. And believe me, these are serious conversations that people have. The other thing is, when I said it was targeting women that are in violent relationships, and they don't want to report who the father is for good reason, after they have a child, the father might be a 6'1", but if that woman is a 6'2", if they don't report that the father is a 6'1", they will assume the father's non-status, and guess what? Their child will be non-status. And then if they want to go and register their child, now they have to go and get genetic proof. They have to let the father back into their life. How fair is that? How safe is that? And I'm not saying that maybe the father isn't rehabilitated. I'm just saying if the father truly is a harm to the child and that woman, is that right? Is that how it's supposed to be? Women still have to be targeted in that way? So, anyway, we still have to put the onus on the women. It's always, always targeted at the women. Clear as mud? Right? This is, by the way, I was on a plane, and I don't know why this person started talking to me about this, but he had worked for Indian Northern Affairs, and he asked me what I did, and I told him I worked for First Nations University, and he said, started just going on, and he said that this system was based on how they categorize prize cattle. He had the gall to tell me that, so that's what this system is based on, so it didn't make me feel very good. When you think about the effects, and I won't spend a long time on this because I want to get to how Indigenous feminism really can help us address legislated identity, I just want to briefly tell you that the effects on Indigenous women, and I use Aboriginal here because all the data comes in as, again, that collated Aboriginal data, but mortality rates for Aboriginal women are 3 times the rate of Canadian women. For status women, there are some data that is individual, but for status women, for example, status women between the ages of 25 and 44 are 5 times more likely to experience a violent death. I mean, that's something that should just jump right out at us, especially when we consider the missing and murdered women. 6 in 10 Aboriginal female spousal victims report injury compared to 4 in 10. So we have a lot of stats in terms of sexual assault. It's much higher. Spousal violence, it's much higher. A lot of it is, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police report said that, you know, we know our own victims, and usually it is intimate partner violence. That is true. But you have to remember, a lot of times people don't consider that gendered roles changed as well, and it's not to give an excuse or an out, but our men also experienced a lot of role changes as well. It wasn't just the women. So if you think of legislated identity, yes, women, I think, were targeted because we were the life givers, but men experienced changes as well. So we had in a very short time, our entire communities were turned upside down, and I don't think people pay a lot of attention to that. In terms of health, prevalence of diabetes is much more prevalent in women than men, and suicide rates among Indigenous people across the board are extremely high. Poverty is much higher amongst Indigenous people. Obesity rates, of course, are much higher. We would know that because diabetes rates are higher and they correlate. First Nations women are 5 times as likely compared to non-Aboriginal women to be non-participants in the labor force. 43% of Aboriginal women live in poverty. I mean, it's just, if you if you asked me to sum it up in a heartbeat, I would tell you that Indigenous women are the most marginalized population in Canada. You know, essentially. Here in Saskatchewan, Margaret just came in from All Nations Hope, and our community partners, Carolyn and Tanya, were working on a HIV/AIDS project, because in Regina here, Indigenous women here have the highest HIV/AIDS rates and the highest injection drug use infections in Canada. So we're working on a community-based project to try and address that, but also look at it from a resilience perspective, because we have lots of strengths here as well. So I'm really happy they're able to join us. I'll just stop at this one here really quick. People who are, I wanted to change the terminology here, who use intravenous drugs are more likely to become victims of intimate partner violence, have a history of childhood sexual abuse, abuse alcohol, and become involved in the sex trade and engage in high-risk sexual behavior. And I mean, that should be a no-brainer, but it seems like we have to spell these kinds of things out, that, again, you have a marginalized population. And yet, if you think about it, you know, these are among the most resilient women, the most resilient women. And so we want to really lend their voice in this project and seek out their help in creating culturally safe care practice when accessing HIV, AIDS, and Hep C care. Now, I want to focus on some of the positive things. I don't want to leave you here really depressed and going out and saying, oh my God, like, what can be done? We're not going to do anything about this, because sometimes that tends to happen. But when we think about how do we deconstruct legislated identity, I think there's lots of things that all of us can do. I think the first thing is we have to acknowledge that many Indigenous people have internalized colonial notions of our identities. And I know certainly my grandfather did, for example. Many of my family members have. I think if we thought about political leadership, we could say, you know, many of our political leaders have internalized some of those notions. So how do we start to really deconstruct that? Howard Adams, I really appreciated his writing, because he actually predicted a lot of what is going on right now. He said, you know, we're going to internalize these notions, and we're going to internalize the oppression, and we're going to become the oppressors ourselves, and things are going to get worse before they get better. And, you know, if you read any of his writings, you'll read it and you'll be like, this guy predicted exactly what is happening right this moment. But it doesn't mean that we can't, you know, come out of it, right? It doesn't mean we can't change things. So we know that Indigenous women suffer from multiple oppressions. And if you think of it, they suffer from race, class, gender oppressions. And not only as a result of external racism, for example, and sexism, but internal. So it's not only, you know, we have to worry about it walking down the street, we have to worry about it within our own communities as well. And so it's those multiple oppressions that are difficult to deal with. So what Indigenous feminist theory says is that the goal of Indigenous feminism is to make visible the internal oppression against women within our own communities, as well as within dominant society, to acknowledge that they exist and to try to start to address them. So the teachings of Mai Kukum are that we as women are sacred beings. And we have to really get back to that. I think that, particularly in our communities, it's starting to happen. But I think that we lost that somewhere along the way, that women are sacred beings, that we're sacred beings in our community. And we have to start again to remember that. We're considered to be equal to men. And we had a patriarchal system that was superimposed in our communities, where that, again, that rule change happened, right? It had to happen. In order for colonization to be successful, patriarchy had to be superimposed and be successful in our communities. So I argue, as do other Indigenous scholars like Kim Anderson and Benita Lawrence, that Indigenous feminism is linked to our traditional teachings and values. So Anderson states that a foundational principle in Indigenous societies is the profound reverence for life, right? And women are life givers. So the teachings of my Kukum are that if we're sacred beings and we're considered to be equal to men, then we have to think about what tradition and traditional mean. And how do we reclaim those into our daily principles of being? So a lot of people talk about tradition and traditional. When is that? Is that pre-contact? Is it post-contact? Right? Because, I mean, that's the struggle, I think, when people talk about, oh, I'm a traditional person. Well, when is traditional? Right? Because traditional is before colonization impacted our roles as those sacred beings, right? And we have to really start to think that way. And I know it's hard because colonization, again, remember as Howard Adams says, has really infiltrated many of our communities. And we have to start to challenge legislated identity. Why do we have to fit into those boxes that we're told we have to fit into? So with the new legislation, I didn't put it up there because I knew I wouldn't have time, but with the new Bill C-3, I could go get my status back. Now, why would I do that? Okay, so I would be a status Indian, and who would that satisfy? So, okay, I would get maybe accepted a little bit more at my institution. Maybe I'd get a bit more accepted when I go and do some research. My community is far, far northern up into the Yukon. So, okay, maybe if I go and I get to reconnect with them, that might hold some weight. Probably not. Who would that satisfy if I got my status back? My ego? People that care about those things? I'm not going to do that for the government. I will not do that for the government. I can be a Tlingit, Anishinaabe, Métis woman and feel good about that for me and my family. And not do that because the government says I should. Because as soon as I do that, I can no longer be a Métis person according to the government. Because you cannot be both. Legislated identity says so. So we have to start challenging those notions, both with the government and within our communities, who tell us sometimes that we need to choose, that we can't be both. Anderson also says that we have to protect our Indigenous teachings and celebrate them and practice them. And as an urban person, that's hard sometimes. That's really hard sometimes. So I really talked about this a lot with my Kukum because I love to go out and do ceremony. She has space out near Moose Jaw. There's a medicine wheel out there. And trust me, I go out as often as I can, but I'm an urban dweller. And how do I have my children involved in ceremony in a daily way? Because I think that's really important. So we started doing just small things, like every morning I get up and I smudge with my children and I put tobacco out. Now I have a modern landscape. I don't have a lot of grass and everything, right? And I said to her, like, this is really bad, but like, I want to put tobacco out, like, what do I do? So I have a big grandfather rock out in the front right by my step. And that grandfather rock is where I put my tobacco. And my little one, if I'm in a rush, which I usually am, because if you know me, I'm always late. I was on time today, but I'm always late. And you know, if I'm rushing around, there's my little one, my five-year-old, Mama, he forgot to mudge, you know? And so we're like, you're right. And so I'm back and I'm smudging, and I'm smudging no matter what. And if we're going on a trip, Kukum showed me how to put tobacco on my tires, and I have a tobacco bundle in my car because I wanted to put a braid of sweet grass in my car, and my husband is a police officer, and he's like, you can't have anything impeding your vision. So even though I tried to explain to him that this is supposed to, you know, protect our vehicle, he's like, well, ask Cookham what else you can have, because he's like, I don't want anything impeding our vision. So yeah, that's my husband. So I have a tobacco bundle in my car now instead of the sweet grass. But these are little things, right? They're not monumental, but they're little, and they're meaningful to me and my family. And then my daughter turned 16 this year, and I asked a really good friend of ours, she's her auntie, to make her her moccasins, her moccasins that are meant for her at this time. And they're very meaningful, and they came with her story of our warrior ancestors from our Tlingit side. And that was very meaningful. It's not earth-shattering kinds of things, but they're daily things, and they're ceremonial things that are very important to us that we do. So protecting those teachings and celebrating them and practicing them. The other thing that we do is we go to full moon ceremonies, but we also do the rites of passage ceremonies. So when my eldest daughter had her first moon time, we had her her ceremony to put her into the rapids when you have your first moon time. And so we held her sweat, and she did a berry fast for the first year, which was very hard, more on me, I think, than her, because I don't know what happened. I think it was my way of challenging her in an indirect way, but she can't have berries, and here I am like, Victoria, do you want some berry muffins? And Victoria, I bought strawberry ice cream. And just, Mom, I can't have berries. But it was, because, you know, she could literally not have berries for a year. And that was her way of, if she could abstain for berries from a year, what else can she abstain for 7 years while she's in the rapids of life as a teenager, right? So we did that. And it was an amazing time, and her ceremony was incredible. And the change in my daughter in that time, in her attitude as a young woman, was incredible. It was something that I wished I would have had as a young woman. And Victoria ended up talking about it to her friends when they asked why she couldn't have berries. Instead of her just saying, oh, I don't, you know, I just don't like them anymore, she would actually say, I'm on a berry fast, you know, and they'd say, well, what's that? I want to do a berry cleanse. And she said, no, it's not a cleanse. It's not a gimmick. She's like, I'm on a berry fast, like, you know, for my moon time. And she'd explain it to them, and they'd be, that is so cool. Like, you know, they'd want to know more about it. So it was so different from when I was a kid, you know, getting picked on, where these girls were very accepting and thought it was really interesting and wanted to know more about her culture and understand more about it. So it's those kinds of things that we're protecting and bringing the ceremonies back out in the open again. And I think that's very important. The other thing I think is that we have to organize and create space for women to work collaboratively and benefit all of our relations. And I think women supporting women is particularly important. I think it's something that we used to do, we don't do enough of anymore, and we need to do more of it. And creating space to engage and work with men who want to deconstruct colonial notions. And I saw Brad walk in here, and a big smile on my face, because Brad is somebody that is constantly trying to do good work in our community for our youth, for our women, and we have to engage men who want to do that. And there's lots of men here, I notice, and that's really encouraging. Men that want to do good work, we have to engage them. And help us to think about new ways to resist, reclaim, construct, reconstruct, and move through our life journey. Because if we don't constantly think about those things and think about how to do that, then we're going to stall. And these are hard ones, you know, how to do these things, really. But, you know, resist oppression, reclaiming our tradition and culture and our identity, and however we can. I gave you some ideas, but there's other ways. You know, everybody will have their own way. And incorporating our traditional indigenous ways into our modern lives, I would like to start learning my language again. I started really small. My daughter wants to learn Cree. So it's those small ways. I mean, our language is the center of our culture. And acting on responsibilities that are inherent in our newfound identities. It's our responsibility as individuals to do that. And it doesn't need to be at the big P political scene. It can be right here, you know, in our everyday lives. And we have to restory our narrative. I think that the stories that I see out there are wrong. And I see it every day, and I spend a lot of time on Facebook trying to restory what I can, because the narratives out there are far too negative, they're far too misguided and not based in fact. And so when you get a chance and when you can restory it, it's all of our responsibility to do that. And I think that that's something that I've been working at a lot, is to try and restory and create a new narrative. I guess I'll just turn that to you. I think I've been talking a little too much. You know, why is that important? Like, why do you think that's important? And what do you think that means to create a new narrative and to restory? Let's see. Well, let's see here. I'm trying to think. Well, it's just more about, you know, the narrative of Indigenous people in general. If you go in the media stream on any Indigenous story, that you know Indigenous people, when are they going to get over it? When are they going to move on? When are they going to, you know, they don't pay taxes, they don't contribute to society. It's that narrative, that narrative that is just so incorrect. And I think that most Canadians think that we don't contribute to society, that we're a conquered nation, that you know, if you talk about treaties, they don't understand that treaties are nation to nation. That colonial narrative is what I'm talking about, I guess, you know. And if you go on to any of the CBC or the CTV, which I never should do, but I do, you know, the bottom, any story on Indigenous people, and you go to the bottom, and the comments, the commentary of people, you know, that's the narrative that they have of Indigenous people, right? And, you know, we have to change that narrative. That's not our narrative, you know? It's not who we are. And, you know, I guess that's the narrative we need to change.
My narrative is the fact that whatever circles I sit in, whether it's my local church or